Special thanks to all of our brothers who have led us so thoughtfully and well this morning. Isn't it good for us to be here? What a blessing each Sunday to gather together. My Bible's going to 1 Corinthians 13. Hope yours will be too. Welcome in the name of Christ, especially if you're a guest. We're delighted you're here. We're interested in helping and encourage you in any way that we can in your spiritual journey. And we're so thankful and pleased that you've chosen to carve out time to honor the God of heaven with your presence today. This morning, we're going to, as we've announced, to wrap up a collection of studies that we started back in May on the excellence and greatness of love. In our very first study back on Mother's Day, we looked at how Paul's love teaching fits into the broader weave of doctrine about Spirit-bestowed miraculous gifts. And, of course, you have the Spirit's even broader intent in this letter to address the carnal thinking of believers in Corinth in all of its manifestations, not just with regard to the gifts. We said three things in that first lesson about love. Not that I'm expecting you to have remembered this, but in short, love is vital. There is no spiritual profit, no pleasing God without it. Love is active, as seen by what it does and doesn't do. And then, love is enduring. And throughout the summer, we've returned to this text here and there, sometimes just for a few minutes. And that was different. Other times, spending our whole study developing these ideas further. Today, we conclude by focusing on the language found in chapter 13, actually verses 7 and 8, as you can see on the screen. We're beginning in chapter 13 and verse 8. In fact, we've chosen for the title of our study the first expression in verse 8, where Paul says simply, love never fails. Now, let's understand, he's not saying that we are always as loving as we should be. There's a revelation. He's not saying that this love will always be reciprocated, because the fact is we understand sometimes, and many times, it won't be. Rather, I believe Paul is saying that this love taught by God has an enduring quality. It has, we might say, lasting strength and power. And from verse 8 through the end of the chapter, he certainly devotes himself to emphasizing that truth about its enduring quality. He does so by way of comparison. Love will endure and remain long after these gifts that the Corinthians seem to prize so much. It will last a lot longer than the divinely bestowed ability to foretell the future, to speak of things to come, the gift of prophecy. Love will endure and remain long after the gift of tongues. Love will outlast every human language that seeks to describe it. And love will last longer than miraculous knowledge will. After that gift has passed away, love will outlive them. Love will remain. Love, he will say, will even exist after faith and hope are no longer needed. We've talked about that before, but love will endure just as God endures. And so I want us to think now, as we wrap all of this up, about the implications of that enduring quality on the practice of love. Because the fact of the matter is, if love has that kind of staying power, then I would suggest to us that it possesses great strength and power for our lives today. This love certainly has the power to transform us into the image of Christ, to help us become like God, and more to the point, to love as He does, to love in that sort of enduring way. Which brings us back to verse 7. Certainly verse 8 is kind of the opening statement that after which everything follows from that. Love never fails. But I also believe there's a connection back with verse 7. Verse 7 describes a love that is constant, a love that is faithful and powerful. And verse 7 tells us what enduring love always seeks to do. So this morning, I want us to look at these four things together from the text. I want us to consider four things that love always seeks to do. And we begin with the first thing listed in verse 7, and that is that love seeks to bear all things. Let's read verse 7 together. It says, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Now, I would imagine we've heard that maybe hundreds of times. I don't know if I shared this. This text was read in our wedding. Has it really been 27 years? Maybe, honey, sometimes you look at me and think it feels like longer. But she shows love for me. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Now, it kind of rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Easy to memorize. I think anybody could memorize that. Now, many Bible translations render a lot of this language pretty much the same. Pretty much the same. In fact, I'll just show you. I'll put a table up here because, of course, I did. That shows how I've got six different translations. We've got the New American Standard, the 95 Update, English Standard Version, Christian Standard Bible, New King James, the King James, and the New International Version. And as you can see, for those last three in the list, you know, believes, hopes, endures, that's pretty much, with rare exception, how all of those translations render that. Believes, hopes, and endures. Maybe it'll say trusts instead of believes, and perseveres instead of endures. But there's very little variation across those translations anyway. I know there are many, many others. But there's a little bit more of variety in how this first one is rendered, the one that I said we're going to talk about first. Now, many say bears all things. In fact, I've got another table to stick up here. So this is the first thing, bears all things. The NIV says always protects. Always protects. The NASB actually says bears all things. I put covers here because that's what's in the marginal note. It says covers. So covers all things. In fact, this word, it got me curious, and I started, this word actually incorporates both ideas, bearing and covering. The word here is derived from a verb meaning to roof over, as in roof, yeah, to roof over, to place under roof, to cover closely so as to keep water out. That could be so in building terms, that's what it would mean. To conceal, to preserve. Think about that. One commentator wrote this: this image would resonate with congregations meeting in modest homes or under porticos, where on a regular basis one was exposed to the elements of both climate and persecution. I like that. I think it's interesting that Paul, who of course was a tent maker, chose a term that speaks of love in terms of the sheltering aspect that it has. I think this language is conveying that love seeks to shelter and to endure and bear up in doing so. In fact, just for the sake of keeping that in our mind, with your indulgence, I'd like to change this up here to just say cover all things, even though, as I said, the word includes both ideas. But to think of that sheltering aspect, I hope you see there is a deep desire here to protect someone. Who are those people for you? To protect someone, to endure, to be willing to suffer long in doing so. True love is motivated to seek always what is best for somebody. It never derives any enjoyment or satisfaction about others' faults being exposed. Rather, it shelters them. It's love's instinct to conceal the faults of others rather than to broadcast them. It has, you might say, a protective bias. Love seeks to provide a safe zone for others that encourages repentance from sin and spiritual growth without public humiliation. Love certainly doesn't gossip. Love shields others from exposure, patiently absorbs the strain of trying to help them get on the right track. For the first of two times today, I want to read 1 Peter 4 and verse 8. It applies, I think, this comes in on a couple of these points, but 1 Peter 4 and verse 8, the apostle says, above all, keep fervent in your love for one another. Why? Because love covers a multitude of sins. And then in Proverbs 10 and verse 12, the Bible says, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all transgressions. I think this is a hallmark of the Galatians 6:1 spiritually minded person. Remember what Galatians 6 and verse 1 says? If anyone is overtaken in a trespass, you who are spiritual, restore them in a spirit of gentleness and humbly, each one looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted. It's a love devoted to, as the language bears out there, I'm so tempted to dig into it, but the idea in Galatians 6:1 is that of patient restoration. It takes love to carry that out. And of course, this love imitates God Himself, who all the way back in the beginning provided covering for Adam and Eve. Love bears all things. Love covers all things. Secondly, love seeks to believe all things. And the idea here, obviously, is not that love is gullible. That's not his meaning. That love will somehow lead one to just abandon common sense and wisdom. No, in fact, if I walk in true love, I'm going to listen to what Jesus and the apostles said in 1 John 4 and verse 1. In fact, John says, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they're from God. So obviously this means something else. It helps me to think about the context here. Remember, the Corinthians were very carnal, very worldly, very, very fleshly. Some of them likely were given to, kind of competing with one another concerning their spiritual gifts. Maybe suspicious of one another's motives, a la King Saul back in the Old Testament, who eyed David with suspicion day after day. A spirit that tries to one-up one another. Oh, you've got that gift. Well, watch this. And in the assembly, trying maybe to one-up one another, assuming others are trying to gain an advantage over them. You see the dark place that mindset takes you? Maybe some in Corinth were becoming jealous and envious when others' gifts were used in the assembly more than their own. But the point is that true love harbors the complete opposite mindset. What true love seeks to do, what it always seeks to do, is to give the benefit of the doubt. I'm not always good at that. To my shame, I say that. Love has confidence in the goodness of people. Not that we have an inherent goodness apart from God, but there is a capacity for goodness, certainly. Love believes the best about others until there is substantive evidence that says otherwise. And I'm just going to say, acknowledge the elephant in the room. That's not how we're conditioned to think in our world today. We are trained to believe the absolute worst about others with whom we disagree. So we need to fight against that by God's grace. Don't answer out loud. Is there someone you know in your family, in this church, at work, just makes you want to pull your hair out? I'm being serious. You know anybody that has some growing to do remember this passage. As you seek to try to encourage them to change for the better, as you try to model the change that you want to see in them, because love is fiercely intent on finding the good, looking for it intentionally, recognizing the potential that someone has for good. I could think of no better example maybe than the author of these words in 1 Corinthians 13. Do you think Jesus saw the potential in Paul? I mean, even as he was taking his followers and dragging them from their homes, moms and dads, you picture kids screaming and running after them as they're dragged away. And Jesus still wanted to save him. Jesus still saw the potential in him. You think Paul maybe thought back to that as he's writing this? I couldn't prove that. He saw the potential in all the other apostles too, for that matter. And he saw the potential in us. We need this kind of love in churches. We need this kind of love in families. We need this kind of love with each other. Husbands and dads, let's make sure we're leading the way in that. I need this passage. Let's resolve this week, you're going to set the right tone. Hebrews 6 and verse 9 expresses the sentiment as well as anywhere when it says, "Beloved, we are convinced of better things concerning you. Love believes all things." Third, love seeks to hope all things. And I think the idea here is that love hopes for the best outcome. Love, therefore, directs its energies toward promoting that outcome. I see kind of a progression in these. I think these four ideas go together, really, as you think about how this would look in practice. So follow this. You've been a shelter to someone spiritually. You've been a shelter to them. You've been intentional about believing the best about them. You pour yourself into them, and still they just flounder. You ever been there? There's some people that would look at me and say, "Yeah, I'm thinking of you right now." A lesser heart would cast them away. "I'm done with you." But a loving heart is still hoping for a pivot back to good. And while the mind understands that the person may in fact be irredeemable, the heart will still continue to leave the door open to repentance and to return. It's the Luke 15 heart, isn't it? The Luke 15 heart of the father waiting for the prodigal to come home. And so this is the heart of parents here. Maybe a grandparent who has a child or grandchild who's walked away from the Lord. This is the heart of a spouse who wants so badly for their mate to become a Christian or to come back to the Lord. This is the heart of someone working with a weak Christian who's just falling and then gets back up. So many times you lose count. But you think maybe this time will be the time that the Lord's teaching will take and they will get it and they will grow up into maturity. And I just have to insert here, this is not in my outline. I think I see the Lord's wisdom here in saying, "I need men like that to shepherd my people," and giving us instructions to find them and appoint them. And I believe we have those men here. This ought to be the heart of every one of us, frankly. Toward a brother or sister who's unruly, who's walked away, maybe weak, vacillating in their faith, isn't it interesting and informative that after emphasizing in Matthew chapter 18, after Jesus emphasizes the need, yes, to administer God's discipline toward one who has sinned, on the heels of that is the parable of the unforgiving servant. I don't think that placement is coincidental. It's a parable prompted. Remember Peter's question that prompted it? Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? And he thought he was being generous and large-hearted when he said, up to seven times? And then he heard what he did not expect when Jesus says, no, I say to you, up to 70 times seven. This is the love that keeps us patient in prayer for one another. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 14, we're reminded of this instruction, which we studied not long ago. We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak. But then he says, be patient with everyone. Well, it takes a love that hopes all things to do that. And so that brings us then to the fourth thing in our list in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 7, where it says that love seeks to endure all things. We might say that love is in it for the long haul. Now, those are my words, not the words of the text. Love will endure lots of things. Mistreatment, insults, slanders, lack of appreciation for what you're trying to do to help, lack of thank you. I mean, even from those to whom we're showing love, love will just endure through that. Now, probably anywhere along the way this morning, I could have read this next passage, but I choose to include it here. John 13. I'm going to guess some of you could quote this, but I'm going to read it. I encourage you to go and see it on your page. John 13, 34 and 35. John 13. I'll give you time to turn there. Wouldn't be fair of me if I didn't. I want you to see this on the page and then just plow ahead without giving you time to get there. All right, John 13, verse 34. A new commandment I give to you, this is Jesus speaking, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. And then verse 35, by this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. I want you to focus in on the expression, as I have loved you, in the context of our point. The point is, from 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7, that love endures all things. Love puts up with a lot. So I ask you, Jesus said, even as I have loved you. You see a connection between that at all? You think Jesus had to put up with anything? You think Jesus had to endure all things? I think we know that he did. I want you to think how much he chose to endure where they were concerned. In fact, this is the night in which he is betrayed. John 13 through 16, they're in the upper room. And so if you're familiar with the timeline, you know that even yet this night, he will have to endure even more. Sleeping disciples. Picking up swords and cutting off people's ears. It was just one ear. Seeing them scatter. That's a lot to endure. That's a lot to... Are we so familiar with all that we fail to stop and appreciate how Jesus may have seen that? But he continued to love them. He continued to love them even as he agonized alone in Gethsemane. He continued to love them even as he would suffer alone all through the night and into the next day. He continued to love them even as one of them denied him. Because you know what his goal was? Is to teach them how to love like that. His goal was to make them disciples. And for 12 of them, more than that, ambassadors of that message of love. And so let's pivot to the one that denied him. Because certainly Peter experienced the blessings of this kind of love. A love that endured all things. Boy, it was clear, wasn't it? Jesus was in it for the long haul with Peter. Aren't you glad for that? Because that gives hope to me. He was in it for the long haul. How many times did the Lord endure his weakness? Once? Twice? I can't help myself. Up to seven times? I dare say it was probably more than 70 times seven. I want to read a passage I read earlier because, as I said, I think it also fits here with this point. Let's go back to 1 Peter 4 and read that again. 1 Peter 4, verses 7 and 8. Now, Peter's much older here. He's the aged apostle. We've been studying this on Thursday nights with the college students. This is the older man, and listen to what he writes about love. 1 Peter 4, verse 7. The end of all things is near. Therefore, be of sound judgment and sober spirit for the purpose of prayer. Well, he's grown in his appreciation of the need to stay awake and pray, hasn't he? Above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. I can't help but wonder how often Peter's mind flashed back as he wrote that. I mean, there are so many scenes to choose from. What about Gethsemane? What about the conversation along the sea after the resurrection in John 21, where three times he asks him, "Do you love me?" Any number of other points along the way, Jesus remained fervent in his love for Peter. He endured Peter. Despite Peter's weakness, despite his thick-headedness, despite his denials. I had Jimmy read from Luke 22 because of verses 31 and 32. Here's what he says to Simon. Now, of course, Simon has said, I'll go with you to death. He just can't accept that he could possibly deny Jesus. And yet Jesus says to him, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat." But I have prayed for you. Wonder how often Jesus prayed for Peter. I think it was a lot. I think he endured in prayer where Peter was concerned. "I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail." You see, Jesus saw the potential in him. In fact, he looks ahead to that day and he says, "You, when once you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." And we just read of an epistle that demonstrates that desire became reality. And for all time, those words strengthen even the likes of us. Because there was a love in Jesus that endured. I hope you see the manifold greatness of love in this one verse, 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 7. Love covers all things. Love believes all things. Love hopes all things. Love endures all things. I can see here the song Jacob picked. Yeah. We didn't collaborate on that. That is great. Love continues to show itself, hear me, until the Lord comes or death comes, whichever comes first. Love never quits. And so it's my responsibility to say to you in the name of Jesus Christ that he continues to love you. He endures in his love for you and me. And if you have wandered from him, he continues to wait for you to come home. And if you've never confessed his name and submitted yourself to his rule, he continues to look on you with love and to appeal to you through imperfect vessels. "Please come to me and I will give you rest." He's endured so much from each of us, and yet He loves us. He waits for us. He hopes that we will accept the Father's offer of salvation and walk with Him, trusting Him for all of the things that we don't understand. What are you going to do with Jesus? We're going to sing about that love, that great love we've had our minds arrested by this morning as Jacob leads us. I want you to reflect on that. And if you see the need that God sees for you to make yourself right